Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, the speaker will be Paul Menzel, speaking on the topic healthcare reform and public confusion. So let's listen in on Paul Menzel.
I'm Paul Menzel. I teach philosophy at PLU. I got involved in health policy discussions about 15 years ago, just when the word cost containment was beginning to hit the health policy person's lexicon. And it took about 4 or 5 years before it to get out in the public lingo, but it's been out there for at least 10 years. What I want to do today is rather unprofessional in the sense that it really doesn't reveal a particular kind of analysis of moral principles and connected with sort of public policy complications that I've worked on in my own work. But instead, just what I would like to do today is just make a commentary on the current situation. A quick one, and move to discussion soon. Just by way of looking at least at one way of organizing the different considerations that need to be taken into account in understanding the current reform efforts, I've drawn this five circle diagram, and we'll be making some comments about intersections between the different circles and how if you pull one thing out of one circle, something starts to unravel in the next circle, and that causes something to unravel in the circle across the way, and that, et cetera, bringing the whole thing to come tumbling down. Simplistically, it's that we have a problem about access, and so health reform efforts start with some concern to increase the coverage, the number of people who are insured in society. Often that's stated as universal access, which doesn't necessarily mean universal coverage, depending on your interpretation. But another consideration is that the coverage should not be just nominal, it should be reasonably comprehensive. This doesn't mean Cadillac care for everybody, it means that basic, adequate health care should be approved, is what should be insured for. So what's insured, I call that comprehensive coverage. I don't mean that by that everything. I mean some reasonably complete package. That you don't leave out surgery, for example, or as actually became a real issue in Washington State, you don't leave out physical therapy in rehab settings. Completely, you might put limits on it, but to leave a whole segment, major segment of what people think of as healthcare out would be to violate that. Quality of care. It's often said the quality of care in the United States is very high. Our problem is access. Who's insured? That's actually difficult to define. I've defined it as, are there sufficient services well delivered? It could be that you have a category like in-hospital surgery or whatever emergency services, say, the big categories of care that are covered in the comprehensive coverage insurance package. But then when you actually get down to what's paid for by an insurance company or a plan, you find that it's awfully thin. All kinds of things are left out. If those things that are left out are things that are important services, really important services, or if the services are there but they're poorly delivered, then we would say the quality of care delivered is deficient. Fourthly, cost containment or cost reasonable. Notice that there are rubber band words in every one of these, except maybe access, comprehensive, how comprehensive, quality of care, what sufficient services, how well delivered, cost containment, what costs are reasonable. But it certainly is a driving concern, and I'll note some statistics in a minute. And fifthly, the fair sharing of expense, or who pays, and of course, what's fair, which we argue about all the time in society, in terms of distributing taxes and benefits. So obviously, just by looking at this, this is a political tempest in a teapot, or worse, and politically it's an extremely delicate thing to try to make any changes in the system. Just quickly to look at the current U.S. system, undoubtedly you basically are familiar with these facts. Our form of payment currently is 50% by private insurance, 25% roughly by public insurance, 25% out of pocket. The financing is sort of four-pronged financing: Medicare in part, which is through a payroll tax, which we should note is, an economist note, is a regressive tax that falls more heavily on as a proportion of income on middle-income people than high-income people. Medicaid, general tax revenue, employer-paid premiums, and note here, here's something that people often don't, aren't aware of, that those premiums are in effect subsidized 40% through a tax break that the government started in the late 40s in order to encourage companies to provide premiums for their employees. The tax break works like this. If you pay a dollar for health insurance premiums, all of it goes toward your insurance. None of it is taxed. If you take a dollar home, however, suppose you're in the 28% income tax bracket, 28 cents goes for income tax, 8% goes for your Social Security tax, 8 cents your employer has to pay Social Security tax, and then state and local income taxes, if there are any, we're right away up to 44 there on that total. If you're be lowered, somewhat lower than that, if you're at the 15% bracket. Approximately on the average, it's 40 cents on the dollar. And notice that since the income tax bracket here is the big break difference, that it's likely to be a regressive tax break, that is, benefit those at high middle incomes more than those at low incomes. That's the way we financed healthcare in our society. And then, of course, we have patient-paid premiums, which are not as tax break subsidized, and out-of-pocket payments by patients. I won't go into these other dimensions, aren't necessary to understand. Now, in terms of who's insured, again, these are almost public household understanding now. 35 million uninsured on any given day, which is roughly 15% of the population. Right here, this figure is 85% are currently insured. Ages 19 to 24, however, 20.3% are uninsured for all or part of the year. Notice that that, of course, is, includes people who think they don't need insurance. That's part of that, what the reason why that's high. But notice that this group, which is certainly a group that doesn't say to itself, I don't need insurance, unlike this group, that it's almost the average 15% of the population. It's not much lower, I'm sure. If you were to look at sort of the mismatch between subjective need for insurance and what is actually there in the system, this is a major mismatch. And one other thing is, the problem that is provoked, posed by Medicaid is that although this number of dollars going into Medicaid for those below a certain income level, an asset level, is considerable, a very major portion of that goes not to those who are what in the target population originally targeted by Medicaid, which was the poor who aren't covered by Medicare. It is instead a considerable number is the elderly who spend down to poverty levels so that Medicaid then covers services that Medicare doesn't cover, specifically nursing home care. Half the dollars of Medicaid go to that population. So that though the number of dollars
devoted to care for the indigent through Medicaid program is very sizable. Only half of those dollars go to the target population of the indigent or the near poor or poor who were originally the target of the program. In terms of costs, this, of all the things in the newspaper and journal articles that I've seen, this I thought was one of the most illustrative. Just look at this curve. The rise in costs as a percentage of disposable income in society is not only continuing to rise at the same rate, it's not plateauing. It is even continuing to rise as a rate of increase. Everybody says, well, the big jump came back in 1967 with Medicare. No, you can't say that. That's not historically correct. There was a jump in 67, but that doesn't explain our current situation. We will be spending 18% of GNP on health care by 2002, or maybe 2000, and we will be spending 22-23% of disposable income on health care in year 2010.
That's all.
Well, if the current system, all kinds of assumptions there, to be sure. The gap, just another cost figure, this is somewhat old, but I should redraw this. This is the U.S. line. This is the Germany. The dots are the Germany line. This green line is Canada.
This is percent of GNP.
Percent of GNP. Well, this is 89. If we extended this over here, we'd have a widening gap to 1994. The figures are always about 2 years behind on this thing. Back when I started to look at this problem, the U.S. and Germany were very, very close, and some people were saying, oh, Germany's the big healthcare spender. But notice the gap, it's widened out since then. What explains why costs are what they are? People argue till doomsday about this. Certainly one of the factors is an increasing amount that the medicine can do. If in fact that produces humanly valuable results, then there's nothing whatsoever wrong with an increase in percent of our resources that get spent on health. It depends what we get for that extra money. Part of the explanation of the increase in cost is that we are an older population, and people on the average, the older you are, the more, once you get above 30, the older you are, the more money is spent on health. We simply cannot, as a society, expect to live longer without paying a higher percent of what we produce in the society on health. Another explanation, factor certainly is that there's a certain amount of administrative waste in the U.S. system. There's a certain amount of administrative expense in any system. How much is waste is the issue. Let me just note, in terms of thinking, oh, here's the panacea. If we can just cut down the amount of waste in the U.S. system, we will have a handle on cost control. Can't possibly be true. Suppose one grants to the proponent of that argument, or one kind of proponent of that argument, that the difference between administrative overhead in the U.S. healthcare system and Canada's is 15%. At the extreme end of the studies, that's what is claimed. Some people claim that in the U.S. the administrative overhead is 21% and in Canada it's 6%. A whole 15% difference. If that were true, and we could wipe out that administrative overhead difference in the two systems immediately by lowering ours, not by raising theirs, what would we? Would we have a handle on costs? No, we would have a two-year break on costs. Because from the previous, one of the earlier charts, you can see healthcare inflation has generally been 7.5% above regular inflation. Now, some years, in the last year, it's dropped actually to about 5% above, 4.5 or 5% inflation. It could be that that's a certain pressures taking hold, and if those pressures hold over a period of time, this might drop. And then it would be a three-year improvement. But 3 or 4 years out, you're going to be back to the same level, and then your rise is going to continue. Because if you take administrative overhead waste out of the system, you take it out once, and then you don't have any more to take out. And then all your other pressures push things up. So the problem isn't going to go away by making the system more streamlined. In the current situation, politically, the Clinton administration called together 500 experts to go to work for 5 months in Washington, D.C., most of them devoting their time out of the most of them donating their time without reimbursement. So my academic colleagues around the country hopped into this and now wonder what's been the point of it. And they came out, the ultimate result of that was a 349-page plan. It was a very complicated plan. You understand certain elements of it from the press, but let me just note that it's quite different than to what we might say are simple alternatives, one of which would have been to say, in Canadian style, let's have a single-payer system, and in effect, make the healthcare system of the country like Medicare. That's basically what the Canadian system is. This does not mean single provider. You can go to any provider. There's only one insurance company or one payer. The other extreme, and by the way, the great benefit on this scale of that is it's quite easy to say more people are covered. You can argue about whether the coverage would be comprehensive enough, but at least it would be basically adequate, or it couldn't fly politically. You can argue about whether enough services would be delivered. That, hidden in that consideration, is what amount of rationing would there be in this system? It's the things that don't do much good that get rationed out in such a system. Fine. If it's other things that get rationed out, trouble. Or if very little gets rationed out, but everything gets delivered poorly, because volume isn't reduced, then also trouble. Cost containment, however, is very easy to achieve in such a system. One just said we have so many dollars for the system. Who takes the brunt of that? Patients in services not available, perhaps, and healthcare providers in fees reduced. Fair sharing of expense comes back to where we get the tax money with which to do that, whether it be by payroll tax or whatever. Another option, not widely noted, because it just really isn't in our political lingo much, is equally effective in providing and meeting many of these goals. I'd use only one example of it here. This was, to some extent, the kind of plan that Clinton, in his campaign, started out oriented toward. But I would note that the healthcare task force of 500 people going to work on the details of the plan, producing a document 1,349 pages long, certainly didn't come up with a plan of this structure. But the structure of, in the completely opposite direction, completely opposite to single payer government financed through payroll taxes or other tax sources structure, a completely different kind of structure, perhaps more saleable in the American political climate, is this. I've picked the particular version of this from the Heritage Foundation. There are many others with slightly different wrinkles. You start with this observation. let's get more revenue for healthcare by eliminating the tax rate for healthcare. That increases tax revenue. And since it's primarily a tax, a regressive tax, that's also fair to eliminate that tax rate. Who screams when you do this? What's the political problem? Of course, it's middle class beneficiaries of employer paid premiums who are currently getting the 40% tax break in effect on their health care. Who are those people? Those are primarily well-employed people. Those of us fortunate enough to have jobs with companies who provide them. You substitute for that a sharply graduated tax credit so that the poor genuinely have access to the insurance. You just graduate this out. You say, if $140 a month for a single person is the premium, the minimum premium for the package of services that are covered in the universal plan, then you say, or the minimum plan, wouldn't be universal because people would buy up, the minimum plan, then if a person is earning only $5,000 a year, they get $100 a month subsidy, and you just scale it out. Everybody pays something, and at a certain point, the government doesn't subsidize anything. But you can graduate this out over any length you want. Notice that we're currently subsidizing at 40% for a lot of people who are very well employed. Very good income. Third, all citizens in this with these tax credits subsidizing their own resources are required to purchase insurance, but they purchase it in the market. There's not just one insurance company. They go out and get insurance. Fourth, you provide higher tax credits, because people will say, what happens to those who have particularly risky, what insurers call the high risk categories, namely they're likely to run up much higher medical bills than others. They'll get assigned $900 a month premiums or $2,000 a month premiums in certain cases. I mean, they won't be able to afford insurance anymore, will they? Well, you take care of that in one of two ways. Heritage Foundation said, let's just classify them in various categories of risk difference. Well, you had 8 different risk levels from the point of view of an insurance company of different subscribers. You graduate this tax credit for your health insurance premium, not just according to income, but according to the risk category you're in. And the risk category you're in is a relatively documentable, medically documentable thing. Insurance companies do it all the time. Why shouldn't we be able to do it? Heritage Foundation said, why couldn't we do it in a healthcare system more generally?
Could you describe a high-risk subscriber?
Person with diabetes, for example. A person 55 with early onset diabetes is a high-risk subscriber. A person with congenital congestive heart failure, all sorts of pre-existing conditions would put subscribers in high-risk conditions.
Would it also include high-risk people in
sure.
high-risk jobs?
It could, if that is actually actuarially related to higher healthcare expenses. Some jobs would, some wouldn't. Okay. Some high-risk jobs may not be related to higher healthcare expenses because they might, if an accident happens at all, it's likely to be quickly fatal. And that doesn't increase health insurance. Cost control, what would there be in this case, unlike the tight cost control of the single-payer system? It would be through vigorous competition among multiple plans. Much more vigorous competition, much, much more than in the current situation, because the tax break would be removed. Right now, you and I don't worry so much about getting the best bargain in the healthcare market, because if our premiums, if we're paying $20 more over here than we had to pay over here, would pay over here if we really looked hard in the market for an equally good plan, we're really only paying $12.
Sure, we lobby our employer to buy the expensive plan instead of the economic plan.
Or, just in terms of, if we're not talking about competition between equal coverage plans, we get choices between what we call lean plans and fat plans. And there, we tend to pick the fatter plan rather than the leaner plan because of the tax break. If we remove the tax break and only did it, only had a tax break because of income need and access need, we would create much more intense competition and shrewd consumer choice of health plans.
Suggestion there is that millions of consumers are better educated than tens of thousands of healthcare purchasers through large employers today, correct?
No, because it could be that the consumers use parties like employers or other healthcare organizers, you might say, to do their consuming for them, because they know the market. The benefits officer of a large of Boeing knows the market better than most Boeing employees. And so, but if you remove the 40% tax break, the benefits office at Boeing would be even do an even harder job, take an even harder look at the comparative costs and benefits of different plans.
For sure.
I mean, it's not a revolutionary change.
You need commonly defined plans, which we don't have today.
Yes.
For the consumer to make an intelligent choice, you have to have a definition of three or four basic plans, and then if there's something that somebody wants to purchase above that, that's fine. But your standard plan is...
Heritage Foundation, you
made. We can't possibly make this choice when we don't know what we're comparing.
This is a nightmare. I work for a clinic of 180 doctors. We have 1,500 insurance companies we deal with right now. Most of them have different ideas of all what their plans are.
Yeah.
And for the consumer to do this, it's totally impossible.
Heritage Foundation, arch defender of the free market in American politics and economics, said, oh, you do need some government organization here. We need, number one, a minimum standard plan.
Well, you need more than
and
a
secondly,
you need several.
You need several
plan
teams.
Variations that are defined
right.
to be common among all heritage.
And we might leave that up to states. We might leave that up to regions. There are a whole variety of other decisions that have to be crossed. But yes, you need to organize the market so that that competition can take effect.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But notice that other than that, or that minimum organization of the market options, this is very much a free market system.
Which has never been tested yet.
Never been tested.
Never
absolutely.
Been tested. All the other plans you've shown in other countries who are controlling their costs have a single payer system.
Right. Now, this is the managed competition. It's managed because there are limited options, not just infinite options, and people are subsidized through a tax credit, but it's competition. That was for managed competition. When you got done with the whole Clinton construction process, it wasn't this kind of relatively simple plan that came out at all. Now, defenders of the Clinton plan will say there are good reasons why it wasn't this way, but just notice that immediately there's a public confusion problem about what is being advocated. It doesn't take a genius to recognize this in the political process.
Basically, this plan doesn't call for huge government bureaucracies and huge government expenditures.
One of the critics I've heard comment on this said, the basic problem was that the 500 people who formed the task forces to construct the Clinton plan were enemies of this sort of managed competition. They were philosophically loyal to a different vision of health care. And yet, Clinton said, construct my managed competition plan for me. Well, you put the fox in the hen house, and you're going to get a problem.
Is it because all those people were middle class and were on programs that benefits and they're the ones
that
we're going to be hurt by the tax break?
No, the tax break is another there were actually a lot of advocates of at least capping the tax break in the Clinton task force, but right at the beginning, I'm told, some people in the White House said, don't do any more than cap the tax break at the very upper end of the fattest packages, the most expensive health package. For them, the amount of money spent on the premium above the next lowest or the next most expensive plan would be taxed fully But we won't tax premiums down further into the main array of plans. The reason the options are limited to that is the guess is absolutely correct. Politically, any attempt to take away much of the tax break is going to get tremendous opposition from unions, who have generally bargained for very good health plans. And they want all of it taxed. And, oddly enough, political conservatives who say philosophically that this is not a tax subsidy. The tax break is not a tax subsidy. It's just, to call it a tax subsidy is to imply that the resources are the government's already. And now, and when you don't tax them, you're giving money back to the individual.
Subsidy. I'm a self-employed person and I pay a huge premium for my medical insurance. And the guy who works for a company gets 40% reduction in that effectively. Right. That, I don't care how you call it. I'm penalized.
Absolutely.
By not belonging to a big corporation to get this tax break.
And we ought to have a better way of working the tax benefit for healthcare than the current system, which is regressive, it's unfair to self-employed people, unfairly benefits comparatively those who work in companies, etc. I mean, there are all kinds of things we could say against, but note that as soon as it was proposed in the Senate Finance Committee that the part of the money for the package that that committee was trying to work out come from severely capping the tax break, It wasn't Senator Mitchell who climbed angrily on the opponent's stand. It was Senator Dole who said, we conservatives don't believe that money is the government's to start with. We think that when you get a tax break, that's not a subsidy. That's what people should have already. This is an alliance between political conservatives and those with good health care plans already. Means that any proposals to make any significant change in the tax break gets shot out of the water.
Which really includes most of the people we have in Washington making decisions.
Yes. So that gets me to this unraveling, this political unraveling. So just a couple more things about that political unraveling. Okay.
I'll ask you.
Let's take the business about who pays. Well, in the Clinton plan, it was an employer mandate. Employer mandate is not so bad if one has, in fact, might be something that people could quite readily swallow, even employers, if there were assurances of cost containment. In fact, all of these other boxes. Were there assurances of cost containment? Well, there were in the Clinton plan. There was a premium cap that was going to be related to cost of living increases. But particular interests go to work most vigorously first on that premium cap. Who most vigorously? Health insurance companies. How did they go to work on it? Well, they said in the Harry Louise commercials, what if my health care plan runs out of money in November? I don't get my surgery in December before the end of the year. Well, rubbish. If we've got competition, any healthcare plan that runs out of money in November is going to be out of business. People aren't going to go back to it. They'll switch plans. You can't run your business well enough to stretch the money out. People will find some other place to take their business. What it does, of course, though, mean, a premium cap, is that there will be rationale. And that gets back to another political book. The no-no word in health policy politically is ration. If you say services will be rationed, you're immediately a target. It means people are going to wait long, 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 long lines for bypass surgeries, for example, when they've got 90% occlusion.
Just different rationing we're rationing right now.
Right.
Sure.
And of course, rationing could be terrible. It could be done terribly. The question is, in a market in which consumers can pick between different plans, would it be done terribly? My bet would be that it would not be done terribly in such a market, since you've got the assistance of collective purchasers with more knowledge of the market representing consumers. Well, at any rate, once cost containment gets dented, the employer mandate gets shot at all over the place. Then what we get left with is people saying, well, let's just have the so-called insurance reforms. Let's structure the market in the following way. We don't let any insurance companies remove coverage for pre-existing conditions. That is, the so-called pre-existing condition exclusions in coverage would be banned in the health insurance market. Okay, we do that. We also ensure portability, so that if you're insured by a company in one job and you move to another job, you can take that plan with you or get an equivalent plan in your new job, and you can't get, your premiums don't get jacked up because you have had something wrong with you in the last couple of years. Portability is intricately related with putting a limit on pre-existing condition exclusions. Thirdly, take care of the high-risk categories, people who all along have been in high-risk categories, by something close to what we might call community rating. We'll have a common rate for all people in the community, regardless of whether they fall in the cheap-to-insure 23-year-old, healthy 23-year-old category, or the difficult, expensive to insure 58-year-old early onset diabetic. But notice what happens when we do that. By the way, in terms of political agreement in our society, the most unanimous agreement we have right now is for the insurance reform. The American public and virtually all of the parties currently arguing in Congress are against pre-existing condition exclusion. They want insurance companies to be prevented from excluding coverage of you for conditions you had before you signed up. The American public wants to ensure portability insurance. The American public, by very, very high percentages, wants some sort of community rating. But because they don't want the first 58-year-old diabetic, early onset diabetic, have to pay $1,200 a month premiums. But when you community rate, what that means is that the 23-year-old is going to have to pay $150 a month premiums, not the current $50 a month premiums. And if you then leave it up to the healthy 23-year-old whether or not to have insurance, a lot of healthy 23-year-olds will say, I'll risk it. I'll go without. You hit them at the lowest resource time of their lives. And so, are you going to get that 85% insured population up to 95% once you have the insurance reforms? Not a prayer. Not a prayer. So, as soon as you do the insurance reforms, you have to require people to be insured if you're going to get anywhere as close to 100% insurance in society. Currently, we're talking about setting a 95% goal, and if we don't make it, then we'll kick in some kind of mandate. If we do make it, we'll just leave the population with 5% uninsured. And then, of course, we'll have to worry about cost shifting, because another thing society absolutely has to face up to is, what are we willing to do with people who show up at the hospital door who aren't insured? Do we really think that a person who chooses not to insure, let us say the 23-year-old, the healthy 23-year-old who doesn't want to pay $150 a month community-rated premiums, should be turned away at the doorstep?
He isn't going to pay a $50,000 medical bill either if he turns up at the door severely.
Will we turn that person away? Will we turn her away?
No.
And some people would say we should, but look them in the eye and say, do you really think you should slam the hospital door? And 99% of the American public will say, no, you shouldn't slam the hospital door. Well, if that's the case, if we're going to pay for them anyhow, then we've got a free rider problem. People who don't pay for insurance and still get acute care.
What's going on right now?
It's going on right now, and it certainly would go on if we had the insurance reforms. It would go on even more. It would go on even more if we had just insurance reforms without people being required to be covered. So the conclusion of that line of reasoning is you have to require people to be insured.
Now, this just hasn't been clearly explained. Hillary has tried to explain it, but I think this is a classic case where what the president needed to do is have a fireside chat, which he went through just a couple of these, not in a confusing way as I thought, but in a much clearer and simpler way, and said, okay, how are the different pieces related here? We just can't have insurance reforms without having some other requirements that people be insured, or we're going to have free riders in the system, unless we're willing to slam the hospital door when they arrive on the steps. And are you willing, American public, to have our hospital slam the door? But we haven't had any talk about that. So I think it's quite understandable why things have unraveled. I don't know how we get the thing back on track.
Why isn't that simply implemented through, a requirement of employment? I happen to be personally and philosophically totally against employer-paid medical insurance, but I happen to think that that's the way it should be collected. It comes out of the paycheck before you ever see it, and that it's a condition of employment, so that the only people who could escape the system are those who are unemployed, who don't probably have any money to pay for it anyway.
In my opinion, symbolically, it was a great mistake of the original Clinton Commission to propose an 80-20 split between what the employer would pay and the employee would pay. Washington State managed to get an employer mandate passed, and it's not being shot out of the blue water even now, and it's only less than a year away from implementation, because it has a 50-50 split. There's something very different symbolically and in the image between a 50-50 split, which you say the employee is responsible for 50%, and an 80-20 in which the employee is only responsible for
20%. The employee is always 100% responsible for paying. The employer can pay nothing for the employee. It must come out of what the employee otherwise could be compensated for the work.
As a matter of economics.
But if the employee perceives that the employer is paying for it, then the employee has no rationale for choosing the least expensive plan and trying to keep himself healthy.
I agree with you as a matter of economic fact that when the employer pays, what that really does is come out of benefits and wages, which the employee would have gotten some other way, probably most of, maybe not all. But nevertheless, perceptions are different, so we might need some kind of employer mandate and the employer having to pick up some percentage to sell this thing politically. But if we do, it shouldn't have been 80-20. Should have been something less.
The plan that you listed, those three or four points that the American public generally agrees on, affordability and labor, is the Dole plan, as far as I can tell. Now, the thing that has never been asked of that plan, which I'm just curious, if Dole or anybody that advocates that kind of approach, is who is going to, it's government regulation, that's in effect what it is. You're going to say insurance companies have to insure people whether they're pre-existing conditions.
Sure.
They have to insure portability. All right, you're telling the insurance companies to do something they don't do now. How is that going to be implemented? Are we going to have a whole set of federal regulators?
Sure.
These are the people that constantly argue that federal regulation is always circumvented somehow or another.
Well, some regulations...
Wouldn't the insurance companies get out of it somehow?
We have that with Medicare right now. Most people who are on Medicare don't mind it much. People on Medicare have federal guidelines about how much physicians and hospitals are reimbursed, what's paid for, how long you can be in the hospital, what you can be in the hospital for. We've got that right now. Most people, in fact, healthcare providers aren't that unhappy with Medicare, and neither are patients.
Well, what about insurers? This would regulate not the providers, but insurers.
Everybody's scared to death of a single-payer system for the people under 65, but actually it's not working badly for people over 65.
But the people that are accepting that federal regulation are people like you. In this, the people who have to accept the federal regulation are the insurance companies. Now, are they going to be happy?
The insurance companies wouldn't be there anymore. That's right. They'd be gone.
That's part of why single-payer system.
Not a dual plan.
In a single-payer system.
In a single-payer system.
Yeah, but no.
So in a Medicare, expanded Medicare system, right?
All this stuff is Band-Aid surgery. And I think that even those of us in Minnesota can see that we need to have something more radical in this. Or this isn't going to work very long. Because this is going to be so complex and stuff that you think the public can understand, but the people who even work in it can understand. I can't understand it. And people who are working inside the system can understand what's going on.
Then why aren't the physicians pushing for their advocacy?
Depends on which group of physicians.
Depends on who you talk to. Depends on who you talk to. In Minnesota right now, you'd be surprised. Most of us are sick and tired.
Sure.
1,500 insurance companies, different sets of rules. Different one insurance company tell you that somebody can be in the hospital for one thing, and the other one tell you they can't. When it's the same condition, plays right at the wall. And most of us are much happier with a situation where where the rules are set. The public can help decide. The public can help decide what Medicare pays for because they can do it in the voting booth. You have no power of Blue Cross and Blue Shield at all. And a single payer system has quite a bit to recommend it. The reason we're in trouble is because we started out being informal based. That was basically the result of the union movement. And the reason we got uninsured people is because we have unemployed people.
Well, I think it's understandable.
To expand an employer-based system is crazy, because that's where we got the trouble we got right now.
Employer-based system had an employer contribution of health insurance was very logical at the time.
But philosophically, why should we have something that's a human right as much as clean air and clean water? The employer-based.
We don't
have our employers help us pay for our clean water or good roads. Everything else that has for quality of life, and all of a sudden, for our car insurance, why should we tack on our health insurance and we're employed? As a philosopher, where does that ever, what, how does that feel?
I'm not in favor of the employer mandate.
It's crazy.
I think there's something strained already in linking the workplace with health insurance.
Yeah, and that's what's going to come out of what we got going on in Congress. You're just going to magnify it, and it's what's wrong with our system right now.
But nevertheless, there would have been much simpler ways to work from the current base of employer-provided health insurance than the Clinton plan. The Heritage plan is a much simpler, I think.
What we're going to do in Minnesota, because we don't think this is going to work, and because it's going to take too long. We're doing a little bit with the Heritage plan. We're dividing up the state into what are called ISNs, Integrated Service Networks. Five or six integrated service networks, and these networks of physicians and hospitals are going to have to work together, and they're going to wind up being capitated for care. So in my region, we might have 450, 500,000 people, and the employers and the public are going to sign up for a plan, and the premium is going to be market-based in terms of what the insurance company is willing to, although the insurance company, it's going to be like a large HMO for a block of people. We're going to get capitated. Each ISN is going to be capitated for the lives they're responsible for. And they'll have a contract with the public about what kind of benefits they're going to have and what the quality is going to be. And we're just going to have to provide it, just like an HMO.
That's the experiment we're working with in this.
So each ISN will go to Aetna or whoever else is going to be able to provide us with the kind of underwriting that we need.
Well, that is the Clinton. That's the health alliances in the Clinton plan.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's managed care to the ultimate. Mm-hmm. That's managed.
It's just that in Minnesota, you're not financing it with employer mandate. Right. You're financing it with other tax revenue. Right.
So how's the rights plan work compared to all these?
Well, WISE is a employer mandate. With choice of various insurance companies.
But there's
not a single payer.
But there's a very high percentage, it's high 90 insurance rate there. And costs have been contained. It's near the bottom of the statewide average increases over the last 3 years.
That's because they got a premium. The essential elements of the WIE plan are employer mandate and sufficient tax revenue support for insurance of those who aren't employed to get that percentage of coverage in society up to around 99% or higher. I can't remember whether it's absolutely everybody or not. Combined with premium caps. That's what works in Hawaii. Okay.
I was just going to ask a similar question. Why is it difficult politically come up with or just even to try a WISE plan or Canada's plan. I mean, it's not. I'm not trying to be naive about it, but it seems like what you say is politically. They're not sorting through it because why were they able to sort through it in Hawaii and make some kind of decision, Minnesota, Washington, or Canada?
Or Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that politically it could work there and can't work for the whole country?
That takes a little more of a political expert than I would even hazard a guess on why that is. I do think except to guess that it was the complexity of both the process and the plan that Clinton came out with that lost momentum of the sense that the country had 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, that we were ready to embark on major reform. But notice that in being ready to embark on major reform, there were still big questions about what direction. That hadn't been settled yet, other than the virtually unanimous agreement that we had to have some insurance reforms. It was banning prejudices, condition exclusions, portability, and something tantamount to community rating. Jim?
Well, and in fact, over the past couple of years, there has been a downward pressure on the increase in costs. I sit on the finance committee of a hospital, and capitated plans, which are basically, for those of you who aren't familiar, you just you bid for how much you're going to get per member of this plan, and you guess that you bid the right amount. If too many people come in, you lose money. If too few people come in, you make money. It's just you make a one kind of one-shot election. That's, at least in Washington, and everybody's coming in with a cafeteria plan. What's happening with Medicare and Medicaid, as any provider knows, every year they cover less and less and less. There are fewer and fewer people to shift the cost to. And so what's happening is that hospitals are getting leaner. They're finding better, less expensive ways to do the same kind of thing. They're running, basically it seems like, at least from where I see it, the free market system seems to be working in a way to at least hold costs down. Now, what's happening? Are we getting more universal access? I don't think so. Fewer and fewer people are coming to hospitals. Does that mean more people are staying sick? I suspect so. We don't know that. But even non-elective surgery is down at the hospital, which the docs on the board can't figure out. You know why there are fewer broken bones coming to the hospital, even to the surgery center. But that seems to be happening. There seems to be a downward pressure that just the increase in healthcare costs are starting to have an opposite effect. And I'm just wondering, just for the sake of argument, what if we did nothing? Eventually, it's going to cost so much that people are going to say, "I ain't going to do it. I'm not going to pay for this. I'm just not going to do it." Hospitals go out of business, doctors go out of business, etc.
You'll get a modest amount of cost containment if you do nothing. Whether you get enough depends on what you want to do with the remainder of the money, the money saved if you had more cost containment. We won't get universal access.
No.
We won't even get close to it with the current market pressures. In fact, I think we'll get further away from it. And if we try to correct that with only insurance reforms, we're going to get no closer to it. We won't get further away from it because it will include some people with insurance reforms, but we'll lose others because of it.
You can't blame insurance companies for all the ills of the health care.
Of course.
And the reason the costs go up.
Right.
They don't make costs go up at all. They're not the culprit for making costs go up.
I couldn't agree with you more, but I do think they are the culprit when they put on a Harry Louise commercial that says, the Clinton plan is going to leave your health plan without any money to pay for services in December, the last month of the year. What somebody needed to do, and it isn't just Hillary going around the country, it's more the whole nation hearing fireside chat fashion, a layout, and there could be competing layouts of the problem, but the country has got to hear it, and not 47 layouts of the problem, three. at most, has to hear that, okay, folks, we've got rationing. It's not just down the road in some future plan. It's right here. And describe it just the way you did. Physicians are under the pressure of capitation payment, not sending people in for certain things. Sometimes that's going to be unfortunate for patients. Most of the time it won't be. Is it worth the bargain? Well, probably yes. But that's hidden rationing. Maybe it's the right kind. But folks, it's here, and it's here to stay. So let's talk about the different kinds of rationing in different plans. Not say there is none. And then pick up the insurance reforms and link it with the universal coverage issue. But in fact, the discussion hasn't really taken that turn at all.
Well, what about New York State? There's a major statewide for state employees insurance company that has dissipated in various millions of dollars. And do you know anything about that? I mean, I just...
Empire Insurance?
Yeah.
Scandal?
Yeah. And there's, I think there's a residual effect of that is a suspicion that some of these private insurers, unlike he says, are in fact overcharging for various services that they provide. And I know in New York there's a big scandal about it, and that's a private, it's a, I think, branch of it.
Well, whoever, we've got a war about insurance companies going on.
Which is a sub.
The Canadian, a single payer system gets rid of them. And a managed competition system preserves them, but manages, restricts them to only a certain number of competitive coverage.
Now, is that what Minnesota's doing?
Do we have any Canadians in here? It's always interesting to talk to an average Canadian and see how much, see what they think about their healthcare system. I live in a city of 100,000, that's about 125 miles from a Canadian city of 100,000. And
they come over, don't they?
Not very many of them. Okay. And our city has two MRI machines and four CAT scanners and two helicopters. And Thunder Bay, Ontario has one CAT scanner, no MRIs, and no helicopters. And people up there are just as long as they're doing in Duluth, Minnesota. And they're just as happy. Most of them, we get a subset of people who come down. Most of them come down for for expedited care. They don't want to wait. It's not that the care they get is bad. They just they just don't want to wait. They don't want to wait a few months for their total.
But there will be the person with a brain tumor who's missed because there's no MRI.
Well, yeah, but there's for everyone like that, there's thousands who get MRIs for low back pain that would have gone away if they just were waiting for a week.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And this is that's the $100 a crack.
Yeah, paid by the insurance.
Part of our increased costs is the fact that the doctors are under a heavy legal burden to guarantee that they will do what is right and not make a mistake, and they have to perform a lot of tests in order to do that.
It's not just a legal burden, though. I mean, if most of you went into your physician and asked for and were told, well, you could have cancer, it could just be a cold that's making you cough, would you rather wait 6 weeks and see what happens? Or would you rather go get your chest x-ray and CDC got a blood draw and things like that right now? Most people would rather have the lab test done and find out to be sure than wait 6 weeks.
But they should be paying for that decision by having to personally pay a substantial portion of those fees for that immediacy, that security. And there is a fundamental flaw in the system. I need to relate something that just happened to me, which is, to me, the cornerstone of the real problem. It's not insurance companies. I bought my insurance in Blue Cross because of the least expensive plan that I could find. And I have a big deductible, $2,000, and a 20% copayment. And I recently had a kidney stone. And the total fees ran to $5,000 to be in the hospital for one day and in and out of emergency several times. Doctors who, from what I could see, spent 10 minutes to do something, charged me $160 for that 10 minutes. And, you know, Blue Cross is not the fault here. They're just the intermediary. They're trying to negotiate some of my expenses down for me now. But there was no critical illness in my situation. There was no nothing, but it was $5,000 for little or nothing. There's the crux of the problem. We can't afford to spend $5,000.